This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly. 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is pre-recorded, however, so if you call in, no one will answer. And for that matter, what is the difference between recorded and pre-recorded?
Welcome back to the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, the ticket online at WTK.com. It's now time, since it's a little bit after 9 o'clock on a Thursday, it's time for the MGO Blog Roundtable, which is brought to you by Homeshore Lending. Homeshore Lending is a local company, and you'll work directly with the owner, a Michigan man, Matt Demarest.
We are back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider, Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, online at WTK.com. You know, I'm happy and I'm sad. I'm happy because my boys are here. You got my man, Brian Cook from MGO Blog.
Hello.
Got Craig Ross. He's been here for a little while now.
Yep.
We have Ed Fang.
What's up?
From the Power Rank. So that makes me happy. Sad because this is the last time for a few months, guys. It's the last time. What the hell? You want your Thursday mornings back for some reason.
We might have a couple more weeks of stuff to talk about.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk, you know, we're not that one-dimensional. I mean, I'm like in mourning that Cardiff will be relegated.
You don't care. Don't pretend that you care.
I'm very depressed that Cardiff is getting relegated.
They play soccer, Sam.
Okay.
And
I have a soccer shirt now, by the way.
What?
Did you know that?
That's great.
That is an AFC Ann Arbor.
No, you got it because it was like neon green and you needed it to match your pants.
Wait, what kit
That's
do you have, Sam?
That's literally what happened to you.
He's right.
He got a Barcelona shirt. And then he asked me, is Barcelona any good? And I was like, have you heard of Leo Messi? And he said, no.
Oh, my God.
Hey, man, but I got the shirt.
No,
I got the shirt. You know, you got to start somewhere, right?
Have you heard of Leo Messi? No.
I mean,
if you needed neon green, you could have got a new Spartan football jersey.
Those things are hideous. You know, we could talk some about Leon Blum and his mistakes.
No, stop.
And we could, I'm stopped. Talk about when Frank Sinatra is going to pay me the $37 he owes me.
Why does Frank Sinatra's estate owe you money?
I paid his bar tab in 1970.
And I have bad news for you.
What's that? He's died?
Yes.
I'll probably never get it.
You sue his estate.
Yeah,
that's true.
It's well beyond the limitations.
Definitely worth it for the $37.
I would watch the people's
charge some interest on that episode.
Did you really pay Frank Sinatra's bar tab?
Yes.
You really did?
Yes. At 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning in a small bar off the strip.
So what did you and old Blue Eyes, what did you talk about?
We didn't talk about anything. There were two people in the bar. He was at one end, I was at the other.
And what are you doing at the other end of the bar?
It's a long story. It'll take the whole show. But he went to pay his bar tab, and he didn't have his wallet. And I thought, I always recognize a good opportunity, so I said, I'll pay.
Are you sad that this is ending now? Sam, it seems like.
what did you have to show? Did he sign something?
No, I just gave him my name and address and said, send me a check because I wanted a check from Frank Sinatra.
And he never sent you the check?
No.
Maybe it got lost in the mail.
Kind of thanks you get.
Craig Ross break. Versus the estate of Frank Sinatra. Next on the People's Court.
All right. So
we got plenty of stuff to talk about.
They're always with you, Craig, no doubt. Definitely plenty of stuff to talk about from last week when you consider there was a controlled scrimmage over at Michigan Stadium. So your big takeaways, or I shouldn't say big take, your takeaways from it?
I think there are a couple of big takeaways. And one is that Harbaugh did give the reins of the offense to Josh Gattis. And it looks like a modern spread offense. Michigan has a jet package that reminded me of the UCF game from a couple years ago, where they're threatening both sides of the field simultaneously, like McCaffrey's touchdown. Jet action one way, they pull the tackle to get a kickout block, and then, you know, it's a one-on-one in a lot of space. And that offensive approach, I mean, UCF couldn't do anything against us because they were coming off an 0-12 season and Michigan had more horse, so their offensive line just got killed. But they still got 275 yards rushing in that game, and I hated playing that offense because it felt like every play was one mistake away from a touchdown. And they of course, got an 87-yard touchdown when Michigan made one mistake. Mm-hmm. So I felt like that was the best possible news you could get from the spring game, is that, yes, Harbaugh has seen this as a problem and has made moves to address it. And they went tempo. Like, they're clearly going to have that in their back pocket this year, so we're not going to have the two-minute drills that take 6 minutes. So I thought it was encouraging.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I was a little skeptical that this would happen coming off the RPO noise from last spring, and because we really didn't have that as a part of the offense, even though we heard that they would. But it seems like everything we heard this time around is on the money. I mean, they were 100% no huddle, just as Warner said they would be. They were 99.9% shotgun. I think they were under center once.
I don't remember
the near the end of the scrimmage once, I think. It might have been with the
fifth string.
Yeah, that might have, that's probably what you did. I wasn't there at that point.
There was a point at which I was like, this has gone on for 3.5 hours. I'm done.
They used fullback 0% of the time. It's clear that slot receivers are going to be more pronounced part of the offense. Mike Sanders still looked really good, I think, and very fast. Ronnie Bell is going to be a good player, and we still haven't seen Giles Jackson, who's another sort of slot receiver type coming in, which is all good. I was also heartened that it looks like they're going to throw more to the running backs, and they can run run the shotgun T with a slot receiver on one side of the quarterback and a running back on the other, and the slot receiver is, at this point, a risk to run the ball, but he's also a risk to catch the ball out of some misdirection. I love that. I think there's a potential for this offense to do, if you recall, what Denard called two, which was two quarterbacks in the same backfield, which we used, I think, in the Iowa game a few years back with Denard and Devin. I think that has some has some potential, right, because McCaffrey can really run the ball, and he's very fast.
Sounds like you kept stats. Did McCaffrey run more than he threw in the game? I started to question. He ran a ton.
He did run a lot. I'm just to finish my thought on it, is there's really four nice things about no huddle and tempoing a bit. And I mean, you're less likely to burn timeouts and get delay penalties, which we had a routine problem with last year. It's harder for the defense to substitute. You can't, change your defense up based on down and distance as easily. Allows the quarterbacks to get into better plays at the line of scrimmage based upon what the defense is doing, because you have time at the line of scrimmage as opposed to fighting the clock. And it's easier to play up tempo when you need to. If you're a brontosaurus and snail pace team, it's hard to go in the opposite direction. You can always slow it down. It's harder to tempo it up. So everything I saw was good on the offensive side. Sorry, Ed.
No worries. Just a couple points. I thought it was very even offensive versus defensive line, which I think is a good thing. I mean, the last time we saw these guys in the spring was 2 years ago, where the defensive line, I mean, obviously with a couple future NFL guys there, just obliterated the offensive line, and that didn't work out well the next season. So pretty even matchup there. Very excited about what's going on both ends. I mean, I think there are questions, but Ben Mason getting some action at three tech, actually making some plays. It was interesting. I was sitting next to a guy, and I don't know if I said something about Ben Mason, but he was like, "Oh, Ben Mason's my boy, and I couldn't find him. Thanks for helping me find him on the defensive line there." And the guy was kind of sad. He's like, "Man," I was like, "You know, he's so good at fullback. Wouldn't you just keep some plays in just so you could run him in the short down situations?" I was like, "Yeah, but I don't think that's happening." So, I would love to see, like, what kind of reps he's going to get on the defensive line and what he can do. I mean, he's probably a little undersized for a defensive lineman at 250.
He's a situational guy.
Yeah, he's like, he might get some pass rush snaps, but I can't see him being
every down.
Yeah, not this year. Maybe next year if he is able to bulk up. But
I mean, aren't you going to still play a little bit of fullback, like goal line situations?
I mean, I think they have probably a jumbo package in there, but he'll get some carries, I imagine, from the tailback spot.
I mean, Owen Schmidt,
right?
Back in the day at West Virginia, was a pretty effective Ben Mason type for Rich Rod, and I think that he might be able to chisel out something like that in the offense.
All right, and they're you're going to see a lot of Ben Mason. You're talking about in that specific role. I think that there's still going to be some set-asides for him, especially in short yardage. scenarios. I think he's proven himself in that regard. But I'm curious what you guys thought. And I seize upon what Ed said about the offensive line. I thought the first string line, you know, I felt encouraged. I felt like they performed to the level that we had heard about over the course of the spring. You know, that's a positive. And then at the same time, it left me, you know, looking at the pass rush with a bit of a jaundiced eye. I really liked Aiden Hutchinson. I think he's a guy. I liked Ben Mason as a situational rusher. But, man, we saw Michigan's receivers throughout the day, minus DPJ, minus Nico Collins, and granted the defense was without LeVert Hill. They got deep fairly often.
Yes. So,
and that's a reflection, of course, on their ability, but the quarterbacks were getting time.
Yeah, well, one of the differences is that when you take DPJ and Collins off this offense, you still have Black. You still have Ronnie Bell, who is really promising. You still have Saunders still. And when you take LeVert Hill off the defense and you're putting, you know, guys from last year's class on the field, it's not the same level of, I got this.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a touchdown to Oliver Martin that got called back where Oliver Martin just dusted Vincent Gray off the line. And Vincent Gray heard a whistle and stopped running, but he was already just beat. And there was no safety. And I've watched Don Brown defenses. They're supposed to be a safety.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of get to that second string safeties, and they're both walk-ons.
And there was another one where Oliver Martin got behind the defense, and I think it was Shea that barely overthrew him.
So there, yeah. So Dax Hill's probably going to walk into a starting job. I mean,
I'm laughing because I've been saying the same thing.
I mean, they moved Kelly Powell to corner, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me because, like,
I think that's where he wants to play.
Yeah.
That's where he wants to play.
But isn't safety as much intellectual as physical? I mean, there's a lot going on at that position. It's not usual for safeties as freshmen just to walk in, understand the system, understand the coverages.
He may not be perfect. I mean, I think you probably expect some growing pains, but he can make up for a lot with his raw ability.
Well, yeah. Guys, this is what Jim Harbaugh this week said about mm-hmm. Dax Hill.
It's really starting to sink in to me, too, that that Dax learning the system and getting up here a little bit early really would help, because it's sinking in that he's going to be playing very early in his career here at the University of Michigan. We can't wait for him to come up.
That's unbelievably honest. I've never heard a coach talk like that. I mean, good for him to some extent. I mean, it tells us the truth, which is safety is a problem.
I've been saying it a ton.
Yeah, I remember that week where he flipped to Alabama, and I came in, and you were like, "No, he's flipping back, and it's okay." I didn't believe you. I was like, "That's crazy. That has never happened in the history of football." And you're like, "No, it's going to happen."
Of course you didn't, Brian.
But then he was like, "I can't tell anybody because I don't want Alabama to like put the full court press on." So he just had to like. It must have been a tough week because you like.
He flipped back after two days. So
just pay attention. Just
I know, but it wasn't announced for a couple weeks, though.
But you know, that week was weird because when Hill decommitted, I was getting emails from people.
It was
really hard for me to say, well, because Sam had already told us. I mean, I couldn't say anything, and so I just kept saying to people, well, just wait, don't panic. That was as good as I could do.
I mean, they need him for the way that they play their safeties. They need that guy.
I mean, last year they had to play outside leverage on the slot the whole time, and so that was with the slants, and then you had. You had to buzz the slant so that they couldn't just get 5-7 yards every time, more like 7-8. But that took Bush out of a lot of the blitz packages, and you kind of saw the end result of that in the OSU game when they have to have two guys on those crossing routes over the middle of the field. They get no pressure, and then that's death. So if they can have a guy in Hill who they can play straight up over the slot and not have to help, that really frees up Michigan's blitzing. And as you referenced earlier, I think you're going to need to do a lot of blitzing this year because, you know, Carlo Kemp gave them nothing in the pass rush last year, and I think he's going to be incrementally better this year, maybe give you a little bit, but I don't think there's going to be a breakout there. And, you know, watching Jeter, he's kind of in the same mold as Brian Monet. He's a space eater now. He's mm-hmm. not really going to burst his way to the quarterback. Got half of a man a couple of times and push the pocket, but I think that's the extent of it. So you're hoping that Mike Dana comes in and the Pro Football Focus hype is real, and you're hoping that I think Hutchinson is your best bet for rush at anchor.
Quiddy will give you some. Yeah. I think Quiddy will give you something too. And Uche, we'll see if he can turn the corner.
Yeah, I mean, he was still just on pass rush packages, so he's not going to be out there on standard downs. I mean... And if Dana does come in and he does live up to that hype, then you don't really have a spot for him on standard down.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, it's very, very unusual for any team, and I don't care what level it's at, to get an interior pass rush. Interior pass rusher is a rare beast. I mean, Mohurst. Yeah. Mohurst was, you know, an extremely unique guy. I think Dwumfor, of our interior guys, is the guy most likely to get pass rush. He's just had that
nagging foot injury.
Yeah, I mean, he's the guy who, like, if there's going to be a breakout, it will be him.
Yeah, I agree with
that. Because he's got the first step to actually be a threatening inside guy. I mean, the thing about Michigan's defenses over the past decade is that they've usually had that guy. They've had Hurst. They've had Glasgow. You know, they had Mike Martin. So yeah. When they've been able to get just one guy who can rush the interior, it changes the complexion of your defense. And I just go back to, like, who was the game where they leapt on Winovich and hurt him?
I can't remember what game that was.
It was late in the year. It was Indiana.
Maryland.
It was Indiana.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember now because I got a text about that from his family, and they said, when that bleep jumped... jumped on Chase's back, but that Chase would be back. The Chase would be back in play the following, and he did. To his credit, he came back and played.
So I go back and I watch the tape, and Michigan's rushing four, and they're just singling up the defensive tackles and outright doubling the defensive ends. They use a running back for one of the doubles, and then they just double with the tackle on the guard on the other one. And that's, I had not seen that before, where it's not like, who needs help? You know, like, all right, I'm going to... Mm-hmm. It's like, I've got the defensive end. This guy also has the defensive end. Because Monet and Kemp were just complete. They weren't going to get to the quarterback no matter what happened, as long as you put someone in front of them. So you need someone a little bit more active, I think, this year, so that they can't do that.
Well, then that's most likely Dwumfor, assuming.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, Dwumfor.
Yeah, and in obvious pass rush situations, I will say this about Ben Mason. It was evident to me. We're in the unpadded practice. This guy is pretty quick off the snap, but you did have to wonder if it would translate to him being able to get upfield and get pressure. And I thought there were a few times where we saw he has really good off snap quickness, not just because, you know, he's going against guys heavier than him. I think he has good off snap quickness against other 255 pound guys. But the reason why you can't play him every down, he did make a few plays in the run game, but there are times where you saw him get cleared out of there too. Yeah. In the run as well. So when it comes to pass rush, though, obvious pass rush situations on the interior, I think that's where, you know, that's where you can get a Ben Mason effect. He gives you some of that interior quickness.
But I think the rush package is probably going to be fine because you bring in Uche. He's going to have an impact. Like, I'm not worried about passing down pass rush. I'm worried about standard down pass rush.
We need to get to a break. We'll pick it up on the other side here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTKA. The Ticket. We are back, folks, here on the Michigan Insider, Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, online at WTK.com. We have the MCO Blog Roundtable here with us. Just real quick before we get to the phones, guys, kind of mentioned in the break, I mean, one of the fiercest position battles, if not the fiercest position battle at right tackle.
Yeah.
Andrew Stuber, Jalen Mayfield. So Andrew Stuber now has, 11 games under his belt, a couple of starts. Jalen Mayfield, you know, saw some spot duty late in three games last year. So experience advantage, definitely to Stuber. You got, you know, youth, athleticism, attitude, edge. With Jalen Mayfield, it sounds like it's a very close battle. How do you think those guys performed?
Yeah, I watched that one. I found some tape of the game, so I've hopefully over the next couple of weeks or the spring practice watch as much of it as I can. But I thought Stuber played pretty well. I mean, I'm still a little mystified last year by the disappearance of Juwan Bushel-Beatty, but by the end of Brian was saying we have four starters back. We really have five starters back because Stuber seemed to be the starter by the end of the last year. I think in the Indiana game, he came in and played the rest of the way. I
thought came in the Michigan State game.
I'm sorry, what?
Came in the Michigan State game. Okay. Yeah.
All right, so Stuber, I thought, played pretty well in the scrimmage. I thought Mayfield looked pretty good, too. I have a slight edge to Stuber right now. I think whoever wins that position will probably be pretty good. There's no reason to believe that this won't be a good offensive line.
And not a thing, but I think he came in both games, Craig. I think he came in against Michigan State and Indiana.
Okay. He did, and then he started the Ohio State game. So, there's...
And the bowl game.
And the bowl game. So he's obviously the guy who is... ahead at the end of last year, has a pretty decent profile. Redshirt sophomore, going to be kind of a 3-4-star borderline guy who Michigan found at camp and kind of needed some time to bulk up. So, he's a guy he could have step into the starting lineup and be pretty confident in, as long as he had some competition. And I think Mayfield is going to get there.
Yeah, it was interesting that Ed made it a point. Ed Warner made it a point in talking about the Stuber kind of getting the edge last year in framing the competition this year. He volunteered, kind of interjected with, hey, he got that by default. We decided to redshirt Jalen Mayfield. Were it not for that, it wasn't like it was a foregone conclusion that it was going to be Andrew Stuber. So, that was him, I think, not just, he's not a give a guy a carrot type of coach. Mm-hmm. Even when it comes to the media. So I take him at his word that this thing is close. So what I wonder is, if you get into the fall and it's close between these two, do you stick with the experience, or in a close battle, is it advantage young guy?
Red would say give it to the young guy, but they're both pretty young. Like, both the 3 and 4 years left. So, honestly, keep them both engaged. Maybe split a few snaps with them if there's a loser, because
both could play next year.
Yeah, because whoever loses that battle is probably going to be in the starting lineup next year.
And Michigan's in a good spot here, because we actually have some depth on the offensive line, which hasn't existed in ever, at least in the last 10 years. And, so I think Ryan Hayes is coming along at the left tackle spot.
It's another year for him.
But at least you have some guys who you could play and probably will see some time this year.
But the interior backups of Honigford and Filiaga and Spinellis, I'd be fairly comfortable with any of those guys coming into the game. And I can't remember a Michigan line in the past decade where that would be fine.
right. You're right. They are building depth. Let's go to the phones real quick. Talk to Don in Ann Arbor. Don, what's up?
Good morning. Sorry, I'd like to shift the focus to basketball at least for a minute.
That's okay.
There was a long thread on Ingo Block that was about Jordan Poole and other players going to the pros, and specifically the question of, do they benefit more by staying and getting coached by John Beilein, or will they get better coaching in the G League or some other minor professional league? And I guess the question I'm asking is, do you guys have any insight as to what exactly the nature of the actual coaching you'd get in those leagues are? Will a young player who still needs work on fundamentals be able to do that in the G League, or are they mostly interested, at least the coaches there, in winning games, and they assume you've got the fundamentals down already? Do you guys have any knowledge about that?
Well, the only thing I know about the G League in that regard is that there are coaches there who are trying to implement extreme experimental basketball systems. They're Craig Ross types. Where it's like, let's try to not shoot any jumpers ever, unless they're from free. So, and you shouldn't dump on the G League, because a lot of those guys are former NBA assistants who are being tracked towards NBA head coaching jobs. So, they're professionals. They know what they're doing.
Well, the big thing is, if you're a student at Michigan, you've got to be a student, first of all. You've got to spend some time on that, and you're limited in terms of the number of hours you can actually even be with a coach
You're nailing it.
And in the G League, you can spend all your time. So I would say theoretically, the opportunities to improve are probably better if that's all you're doing.
And again, I think we. you know, and I understand it from a fan perspective. You sort of impose and project your judgment on these guys. It's not really important whether we think you get better coaching in the G League. Right. And I'm not saying that that's part of the calculus here. But assuming for the sake of argument that it was, it doesn't matter if we think, oh, well, they get better coaching staying. It's about what they think. If they think they'll get better coaching leaving, then that's all that matters. I think it's more about what Craig said, though. You got a situation where you are working full time on your craft. You don't have to pay any attention to academics worrying about school. And you are every day in practice and in every game going against pros. So you're going against pros all the time. You're playing all the time.
Yeah.
You're getting paid, maybe not, you know, an NBA wage, but you're getting paid. And so for a lot of guys who just don't want to do school anymore, it makes more sense.
I mean, you're moaning. I think that, you know, you don't have the pressure when you're going up against, you know, the Mad Ants in Fort Wayne, mm-hmm. and there's 500 people in the stands. It's a different environment. You don't get the kind of publicity you do.
You don't.
And, like, I think in John Beilein's specific case, he has a track record that, yes, he's better at developing basketball players than anyone in the G League. Now, if you're talking to me about, like, Tom Crean, yeah, go to the G League, whatever. Talking to me about
It's also a matter of number of games they play, right? So they're playing 50 games in the G League. And, you know, for someone like Jordan Poole, like, I think he needs more game seasoning, right, in terms of both shot selection and
If Jordan Poole leaves, it's not going to be because it's the best thing for his future. If Jordan Poole leaves, it's because he's taking a step back jumper with his career. I mean, that's what it is.
What does that mean?
It means they have poor shot selection, and this would be a bad shot.
Well, see, but there are examples, and I'm not saying that I track every guy who went to the D or G League and transitioned into great success. But the guy that comes immediately to mind to me was a guy the Pistons drafted a couple of years ago, Spencer Dinwiddie. You know, he came in, didn't get a whole lot of time, you know, jumped back and forth between Pistons and the D or G League and bounced around at that level and in that scenario for a couple of seasons. Now you look at that guy, and Spencer Dinwiddie's a dude. I mean, he has grown into being a piece, with the Nets. And I really feel like you see more guys feeling like that's an option. Especially those, and this is what we got to get right with as fans, some guys just don't want to do school anymore.
Sure.
And we could until we're blue in the face, match John Beilein's player development, which is outstanding. You can match it up against, you know, every G League coach there, and it doesn't matter.
I know.
If a guy doesn't want to do school anymore.
So they had the presser or whatever yesterday where it's like, no, I'm not decided. You sound like you think that this is a decision that's been made.
Come on, man. Jordan Poole, I'd be shocked.
So let's talk about the next guy instead of the last guy.
So Iggy, I mean, do I think the door is wider open with him than with Jordan Poole?
That ESPN article where it's like, I'm going to go and get drafted.
I'd be surprised if he comes back. I wouldn't be shocked if he comes back. I'd be shocked if Jordan Poole comes back.
And I'm telling you that's a bad decision.
I mean, I agree with you,
for Jordan Poole?
Yeah.
Hey, well.
I mean, I agree with you, but, you know, I don't think it's a complete...
Like, if I'm an NBA team and I saw him melt down in all three Michigan State games, I'm not touching that guy with a 10-foot pole. And
his Purdue and North Carolina games, you're like, let's see where the upside is.
Yeah, I'm sure that he's got upside, but like, I'd need to see him come back and be like, and grow up a little bit. That's what I would need to see as an NBA team. And like, cutting and running is not what I want to see.
But NBA teams draft guys on potential, right? Like, that from the history.
There's a lot of guys with potential.
And for guys, again, when we look at the calculus, for guys that think they're ready, he said he thinks he's a pro. If you're not a pro in the NBA, and the G League isn't tenable for you, it's beneath you or whatever, you go play overseas.
Sure.
If you feel like you're a pro, that's what you're ready to do.
What's happening here, okay.
If he feels like a pro, that's fine. But he's not a pro in the NBA next year, right? I don't think anyone here is going to make that case for him. He's not a pro in the NBA next year.
I don't think so.
Do you want to be a pro in another league? And maybe that's the right decision.
Yeah,
for
do
him.
You want to be a pro regardless of where it
Man,
is?
I mean, I was looking up Alba Berlin numbers, and you know they got Derek Walton playing 5 minutes a game. Like, maybe he can go play in Turkey, but like, Berlin's not going to take him.
Hey, like, and it may be a rude awakening for him in that regard. But if that's what you want
to
do?
I mean, he can shoot. If he goes to the combine and puts up 60% on NBA threes like he was doing halfway through the year, then yeah, sure. But, yeah.
Is he going to be invited to the combine? I don't even think
that's actually a really good question.
That's not 100% certainty. Yeah. I mean, first of all, and Beilein is in a really, I mean, unless John knows a lot more than we know, which is likely, you know, to say the least, he's in an odd spot. Now, maybe if he knows Franz Wagner is open to coming, doesn't matter with Iggy, you know, Iggy can go, Franz can come, and Franz can come in July, you know, it doesn't matter. But he's sort of at an odd spot with Poole because he's got kids that he's looking at now.
I think it's an odder spot with Iggy.
Really?
Yes.
I don't think it's an odd spot. I think both guys are gone and he's recruiting.
That could be.
I'm gonna give you my strong gut feeling on the thought process.
Okay.
I think they are pretty, this is my opinion, it's what my gut is telling me, I think they feel like JP's gone.
Okay.
All right? I think they feel like the door, that Iggy is leaving the door open, that whatever feedback he gets could, whatever further feedback he gets could influence him to come back, but probably there's no doubt leaning toward being out the door. So it does put you in a bit of a situation if you're leaving the door open somewhat for even one of them, which they have to do to a certain extent. But at the same time, you got to go out and recruit with both spots. The fortunate thing for them is the timing with Franz in particular is good.
Yeah.
The timing with him is good. He probably doesn't, you know, he isn't going to be in any rush to make a decision. And, you know, if it's left up to him, and it's not like Michigan is in early May and say, hey, we got two guys ready to come. What you want to do? If that doesn't happen,
let's be real. If Franz wants to come, he's coming.
That would be my take.
Well, yeah, that's why we're saying the timing.
Here's how I would phrase it. If they got in a situation where two guys wanted to come, I think there would be, and this is, again, this is pure speculation right now. This is just me. You putting some things together and using a little guesswork. I think they pick up the phone, call Franz, and be like, look, now someone's ready to come. We need to know what you want to do. I mean, he has another month or so before he's done. You know, maybe at that point he's ready to make a decision. I know they have the family, and I know Mo is an advocate. The family, they're advocates for Michigan. The question is, do you want to stay and be an ambassador for the sport in your native land and be a guy who came up through the grassroots program and, you know, became a pro? You can get your degree as part of their program too. Yeah. And get paid at the same time. You can do all those things over in Germany. Or do you want to have the cultural experience that your brother had over here? It's really, when you hear him, when you read what he has to say, it's less about the path to the pros and more about cultural enrichment. You come to America,
that's a good thing.
You see a totally different reality. That's what he's saying anyway. So,
well, I mean, there was an article that Google translated, so I take this with a grain of salt. But he said something along the lines of, you know, if I sign with Berlin, all I'm going to do for my life is play basketball. And I was like, okay, that sounds actually pretty encouraging, because that's like a guy who would want to come and see some other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to have
like
interesting life experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think the good news for Michigan is if he does go to college, it will be in Ann Arbor.
It will be in Ann Arbor. And, I am confident of that.
And that makes the timing on those matters easier. On the on the other guys they're looking at, it's a little tougher. Now, we've talked about Harlan Beverly.
So he's gone to Miami. Yeah, let's pause and we can come back on the other side and you can talk about Bones.
I want to talk about Bones.
Talk about Bones. So we'll do that in return here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050. WTKA the ticket. But before we went to the break, Craig was itching. He wants to talk about Bones. So tell us about Bones.
Well, Michigan was recruiting a guy named Harlan Beverly, but he's committed to Miami, so he's gone. Lester Quinones is a nice player. Reminds me some of Poole in his game. I think he's coming on an official visit.
He's slated to come at the end of the month.
But I'm skeptical of him. I don't know about you. I think there may be structural issues there, too. Let me call it that.
I don't know about that. I know that he is a guy that Yach has been on for a long time. Mm-hmm. Going back to last year, they kind of fell off when they picked up Bajima. But as space opened back up, they revisited him. He is a guy that gives you some 3-and-D possibilities, and he's a guy that would come in and would be very familiar with the system because John Mahoney ran John Beilein's offense down at IMG. So he would come in with more of a baseline, with a higher baseline than typical freshmen. I think that's part of the appeal with him.
Yeah, and but then all of a sudden, just in the last week, there is noises about a kid named Nashawn Hyland, known as Bones. And he's known as Bones because he's somewhere between 6'3 and 6'4, and he weighs in at 160. And Ed asked me, well, is he thinner than Colin Castleton? I said, yes. Ed, no, he is thinner than Manute Bol.
Yeah, there's a guy that Michigan actually had a commitment from back in the day that never made it to Ann Arbor, named Jaquan Hart.
Oh yeah, I remember.
Yeah, that guy was rail thin. That's this kid.
Yeah, there's nothing to this kid. But I turned the highlight tapes on about 4 or 5 days ago, and I was blown away. And how come this guy, you know, no one's recruiting? He has offers, I think, from St. Joe and Temple. He's from Wilmington, Delaware, perhaps. Or from Delaware. And not far from Philly. And so he's got a couple of the Philly schools interested. And I couldn't figure it out. Well, apparently he got injured jumping out of a burning building and missed missed his junior year of basketball. Being injured on this is a tragedy because his grandmother died and his younger brother died in this fire. Mm-hmm. And but you look at his tape, and the thing that stands out is he is a remarkable ball handler. He has an incredible handle. He sees the court,
You're talking about full games here that you've been watching.
Well, no, I'm just talking about the highlight stuff. But what struck me was even though he weighs 160 pounds, he's tough as nails. He is a really tough player. Now, he plays no defense, but he's a tough guy. So I looked last night at two full game tapes against pretty good competition, and you see a lot of the same things. You also see he plays no defense, and which I think is fixable because he's a good athlete. And you see him taking terrible shots over and over and over. I mean, he makes some shots, but so there's work to be done there on his game. But I know Brian Snow, they had him rated at like 170. But Snow thought he was a top 50 player in his junior year.
Well, 24/7 just moved him up to 69.
Okay, so they've moved him way up, and rightfully so. I think that's probably about where he should be. There are gaps and holes, but the gaps and holes aren't in his ability to handle the ball, the ability to see the court. The issue I've got is he seems more like a point than a two to me. And I'm not saying he can't play the two.
I mean, you are who you can defend. So if he's 6'3", 6'4", I think he's got the length to defend him.
And,
that's a fair point, Brian.
It fits with them moving forward because in Dave DeJulius and Zeb Jackson, you got a couple of guys that excel playing off the ball if you want them to. If you want them to. So they don't need to be ball dominant. You can have him be... You can have him be your trigger guy if you want that, if you're John Beilein. I mean, he doesn't have to have that.
He looks like an isolation player.
And Which you need.
Yeah, Michigan needs an isolation player because, I mean, we saw last year, I mean, if you can't punish switches, and that's one way to do it. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, the other thing about Bones is he is going to just kill it in the pick and roll game. Because he's long, he's got long arms, he's closer to Darius in that respect, and I don't see any reason why with, some good coaching that he won't just be a killer in the pick and roll game.
His listed height seems low. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I agree. Arms. They list him at 6'3". I think he's probably 6'4".
It sounds like this is like full court press time for Michigan.
Yeah, so I feel like he's emerged as...
two-guard target?
Yeah. I feel like he's
okay,
he's
I did not
that
know
guy.
That.
This is my, again, I'm giving you my my informed speculation on the matter, but that and that's not meant to exclude the very serious, strong, persistent pursuit okay. of Franz.
Oh,
of Franz Wagner,
yeah, yeah.
Of Franz Wagner. So, you know, that's where the dance comes in. You still got Justin Pierce that you're looking at.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not.
Pierce, you should mention, is a grad transfer.
Right.
He'll be here for
William
one
and Mary.
Year. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we'll see how that goes as far as this current recruiting cycle goes. And I haven't seen any film on that guy, honestly. Have you watched any film on Justin Pierce?
I've watched some highlights on him. He seems like a Duncan-esque kind of player where he's going to be a little bit limited on defense, but has the ability to shoot. Like, last year wasn't that great, but he's a 41% shooter as a sophomore, and he's a playmaker from the perimeter as a wing, so he could add some shot creation, which is something Michigan will need.
He's a pretty good rebounder. You know, he's a pretty good passer.
Well, so he had a point guard when he was a junior and shot 41% from three, and then he graduated and he picked up a lot of the playmaking burden. So, and I think in a Z environment, or an X environment rather, he'd be able to get back to that.
And you know, if Franz wants to come as a next year, he's only 17 now, then I would see...
Franz will be here in the fall.
Well, that would be huge.
That would be huge.
Absolutely huge. That'll do it for us, folks, here on the Michigan Insider.
Who's got it first?